Hello, growers from around the world. Thanks for tuning into GrowCast. Jordan River here. We've got a Dr. Coco for you, and Ask Dr. Coco, where we focus on plant training, but we talk about other stuff too. It's a fantastic episode. Before we jump into today's show, though, let's shout out Buxton Hollow Farms, everyone. BuxtonHollowFarm.com is where you would like to go for your natural soil inputs. Promo code GCL10 gets you 10% off site-wide. Members of MyGrowPass.com getting 20% off BuxtonHollowFarm.com. Buxton Hollow Farm is a small, family-owned business, and they are the purveyors, makers and purveyors of premium quality natural soil amendments. They have compost tea kits. They have coir seed starters, pre-charged or plain biochar, whatever you need, they got it. If it's natural, they got it. And their products are mixed fresh, hand-mixed to order, so you know you're getting the freshest, most biologically active product possible. Again, for all your compost tea needs, your nourished coir needs, BuxtonHollowFarm.com, promo code GCL10 for 10% off. MyGrowPass.com members getting 20% off and lots of goodies in the giveaway from the very generous Buxton Hollow Farm. What else do we have going on? We got the giveaways are rolling over. Today's your last chance. I mean, you have a few hours to get in on the trim bag as this drops Wednesday night. And then we're switching over to Diamond Cutco Scissor giveaway. Very exciting. All of this can be found at growcastpodcast.com/giveaway. growcastpodcast.com/giveaway for you listeners. We'll be rolling them over every 2 weeks. What else we got on the list? That about does it, everyone. We're going to be doing a nice live stream this weekend. We got some new team members. That's exciting. Stay tuned for that. Make sure you're following us at GrowCast on Instagram and follow me at Jordan River IG. I think that's all for today. Enjoy this wonderful episode with Dr. Coco. Best of luck in your grows. Enjoy the program, everyone. Hello, podcast listeners. You are now listening to GrowCast. I'm your host, Jordan River. Thank you for tuning in today. Before we get started, share GrowCast. Always share GrowCast with a grower, with a smoker. Make sure you're subscribed. Give us a good rating and review. It really, really helps us out. Check out the Homegrown Helpers for more growing talk, and the Coffee, Health, and Science podcast for regenerative farming talk, health talk, coffee talk, and more. There's actually a really great Coffee, Health, and Science podcast episode, four times coffee was criminalized or demonized throughout history. It ties really well into the prohibition of cannabis. I might post that here in the feed. It's a really, really cool episode. Anyways, today's episode of GrowCast features Dr. Coco once again. What up, Dr. Coco?
Hey, Jordan. It's nice to be back with you.
Always, always. We have so many questions flooding in that I realize we got to pick up these FAQs because the list is growing and you go deep. So today we are back with another Ask Dr. Coco. We're focusing on plant training today. I'm very excited to dive into this topic. Also excited to be part of the Coco for Cannabis Grow Challenge. Things are going well with my seedlings, Dr. Coco. How's your grow going? I know I got started late.
Yeah, how are your little seedlings doing?
So they went good. It's I've grown countless clones, but I've never popped cannabis.
Yeah, no.
So I did a great job on my first run of Mosca, and they are Mosca Bubblegum Gelato, and they're very, very vigorous. I instantly got complacent and kind of fucked up the Keturah Kush when I transferred them from the paper towel to the soil, and I let one kind of like wash away, and it was too exposed. And it didn't pop. So like, it was funny. I was like, this is easy, and instantly got complacent and like messed up.
Yeah.
But I still got four Keturah.
That's the best of us. I got complacent on this grow too, and it bit me. So I feel you there.
Totally. Yeah. And then I popped some Grand Caper, and those are catching up very, very nicely. Shout out to Purple Caper, cultivated choice with the Keturah Kush and Mosca. What's going on in your grow? Yeah. You said, what was the, classic mistake that you made, overwatering or something like that?
No, there's no
overwatering. Oh, you're in Coco. Duh. Overwatering. There is no overwatering.
So, well, you know, I have a bunch of Royal Gold Coco that Rick Elliott from Royal Gold sent me. And
unbuffered, that's right.
It's really good stuff, and I've been using it, and, you know, you don't have to pre-buffer it. You don't even have to rinse it out. It comes moist. All I need to do when I'm using that Coco is, like, pre-fertigate. You know, provide the water that it needs before growing. But, you know, we're under lockdown, and I wasn't aware that I didn't have perlite. I usually have a big bag of perlite, but as I was getting sort of my stuff ready to go, I realized that I had used all my perlite, and having all the cocoa in the world wasn't going to really help if I didn't have any perlite to mix it with. So in a pinch, I decided I was going to have to recycle some cocoa from the grow that I had just harvested. I just didn't recycle it properly, following sort of my own instructions about how to recycle it. I got lazy and tried to cut corners.
Should have brought up your own website article, man.
I know. It's like, how do you learn how to do this? Like, read the article that I wrote. But yeah, so I feel you about complacency. You know, I thought I could get away with it. I thought I'd just flush down the cocoa, verify that, you know, the water running through it was low enough in EC, and just refertigate. And there's several things. There was too much peat in it, but it really seems like I didn't flush away all of the potassium. So it was K-rich, and the plants, the two little sprouts that I put into that sort of potassium-rich hot cocoa, shriveled, like really actually kind of shriveled. I nursed them, and I could have gotten both of them back, but they're autos. And, you know, when you screw up an auto with that degree of sort of, you know, profundity, it's tough to recover. And the plant's never going to sort of be able to get back to what it could have been. So, fortunately, I was only running half of my plants in that, and I had tuber. This was sort of my dilemma when I was there deciding to rebuffer the cocoa or to do something else when I didn't have perlite. I have a bunch of tuber, and tuber comes pre-mixed with perlite. So,
what is the composition of tuber again?
You know, it's basically cocoa, perlite, aged forest products, and some peat, but it's a high porosity blend. It is cocoa based, but it's not
exclusive. It's got the peat in it. Right.
Yeah. But the high porosity blend means that it's designed for high frequency fertigation. And that's actually a question that's come up, with some other, HP blends. So if you see that, there's various products that are marketed as a high porosity, structure.
Sure. Like HP Promix.
Yeah, exactly. That's designed for a high frequency fertigation. And so the tuber is designed to, you know, have excellent drainage and excellent water retention capability.
Is it just like cocoa, to where if it's fully saturated, you don't have to worry about suffocation?
Yes.
Well, there you go. I'm glad, because I was going to ask you.
They say it's designed for 5 to 6 times fertigation every day, which is what I do with cocoa well.
Sounds like plenty.
So yeah, I've never run the tuber before. I've had it for a long time, and so I decided I'd run a couple of the plants in that. And they've been doing fine sort of throughout. They didn't have any of the issues that the cocoa plants did, which sort of re-verifies the fact that it was the media was the issue. But they did develop a little bit of magnesium deficiency, which surprised me. I didn't realize that the tuber was going to need quite the dose of CalMag that it actually does. It needs pretty much the same dose that the cocoa does, I've found.
Interesting. So I was just on live stream for GrowCast last night or 2 nights ago, and someone asked, you know, what cocoa can you recommend? And I was stoned. I should have thought back to Mark Morrow and Gorilla Boost and his work. But I said, listen, I never grew in cocoa. I shouted out tuper because Wolfman loves them. I know you've heard.
Yeah.
Talk to me about cocoa brands next time someone asks me that. And more importantly, are there any brands that we should maybe not, you know, maybe some brands that we should avoid?
You know, there are some brands that I avoid. I hate sort of throwing companies under the bus when I don't have a lot of personal experience to do so, right?
Well, let's start with the ones you recommend, and we'll go process of elimination
based on other people's experiences with them. I really do recommend the Royal Gold Cocoa. If you're interested in a bagged product, so there's basically two routes to take when you're buying cocoa. You either get a bagged product, which is not compressed, and it's pre-buffered. They're all pre-buffered to some extent. I haven't found any of the bagged products that are just straight not buffered at all. But some of those buffers are different. Most of the growers in our chat room and forum, they grow with a Mother Earth or Kana or various of these other pre-buffered products, buffer them again themselves. So that's just soaking it in CalMag water before use. And, you know, we have a lot of sort of experience in the forum to suggest that that buffering helps again.
Wow.
But you don't have to rinse them out. So if you're concerned about your bagged cocoa product, it's always a good idea to give it an extra soak. Like I was saying, with the Royal Gold, I've definitely been able to avoid that and just use it straight out of the bag for their straight cocoa products. Now, they have different sort of cocoa products, like the Tuper, like we've been talking about. The Tuper was a little bit hot. The Tuper, when I poured RO water through it, sort of saturated it in RO water and then poured a little bit extra to get some runoff. It came out initially at an EC of about 1,000, or PPM of about 500, which I consider really too strong for seedlings. So I flushed it down a little bit, to use that for the seedlings, but it should be fine for higher stages. Now if you get a brick cocoa, you need to buffer that. You need to probably rinse it. So you rehydrate it, you rinse out, because it'll have way too much peat, the dust in it. Rinse out some of that peat and then soak it and all of these things. And if you do that whole process, you can start with really any quality product. And I still want to say quality. I caught myself there a little bit. There are some, it's possible to find cocoa that hasn't been properly aged. And I don't see much of it on the market, at least not much of it in the market in the United States. But if you're not ending up, concern,
but it does exist.
It does exist. Most of the products that I see that are available, though, are aged cocoa. They're in bricks, but they're not buffered. So when you get a brick of cocoa, you should first rinse it out and then buffer it up. And if you do the rinsing and buffering process well, it pretty much doesn't matter, between the different brands, because you're sort of doing the quality control
Interesting.
Side.
Interesting. Okay. Okay. That's a good take.
But yeah, if you're looking for a bag product, I mean, the big benefit of the bags is that they don't require nearly as much processing work, but I sort of feel like if you're going to get one that requires it to be rebuffered again anyways, and I will say, you know, we've been seeing issues with people growing in both Mother Earth and Kana when they're not pre-buffering themselves. And when they do pre-buffer themselves, they're not having those issues.
So if you were at the store and you were just in a kind of sleepwalking state, you would gravitate towards the Royal Gold, and maybe those other ones wouldn't be your first choice.
There's a, you know, it's a sliding scale between paying more or doing work yourself.
Sure.
So if you get all Royal Gold bagged cocoa, it's probably going to cost a lot more than if you buy bricks of cocoa. It is definitely going to cost a lot more than if you buy bricks of cocoa. It's probably going to cost a little bit more than some of the other bag brands. But yeah, if you're looking at a bag of Kana and thinking like, okay, I'm going to have to soak this in CalMag water, or a bag of Royal Gold and thinking like, I'm not going to have to soak this in CalMag water, then you have to decide, you know, how much do you want to save for not having to do that work?
Like everything in gardening, it's crazy, especially growing cannabis. It's so amazing because there's that trade-off. And then there's also how there's all these different worlds that just never intersect. Like, I just got off of a call with Stephen Raisner, and he was showing me his, one of the grows he was consulting on. And it's an aquaponic grow. It's like, I've never had experience buffering cocoa. Seeds are new to me. You know, I was paying my bills growing for 5 years, but it's like these worlds never intersect. There's a million ways to do it. There's a million ways to have great success, which is also strange. And
the buffering cocoa thing is one of the sort of laborious parts of growing in cocoa. And then the seedling stage is a little bit tough. And so people often around like the second week of growing a cocoa, they're like, why am I doing this again? But by the third week, their plants are like exploding. So it's one of the sort of trade-offs that we do to get the air-to-water ratio and the...
Oh, that lovely air-to-water ratio.
Yeah, the cation exchange principles of cocoa are so favorable to growing later on that, you know, it's worth the added investment in some of these things in the beginning.
But I'll do a cocoa grow for you, Dr. Cocoa, I promise.
All right. Yeah, no, I'd be awesome. You know, once you go cocoa, it's not a lot of cocoa to soil migration that we experience
once
here.
Once you go cocoa, you can never not loco. That's what I would put it here.
What's that?
Once you go cocoa, you can never not loco. That's what I would put at the top of the website. You can pay me for that one later.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to get plants to grow as sort of healthy and as quickly in other media as you can get them to grow in cocoa. So it can be a little bit sort of disenchanting to go back to slower, less healthy plants.
You know, I should really just do a panel and get you and Reisner and just like all the different, you know, we'll just have a all out feud, and then maybe we'll stream you guys playing Mortal Kombat or something. We'll do like a tournament where you actually get to fight each other.
Yeah, I mean,
then we'll know who's going to is the best.
You know, I had a debate with Jeff Lowenfels. He of you know, Teeming with Microbes fame.
Of course, is that recorded? Can people?
Yeah,
find
it? Yeah. There's a cheap home grow grower versus bud versus bud episode, and it was pitched to me as a debate. I'm gonna go there. I'm taking.
Jeff was like, holy crow.
Well, I mean, he came on the live show with us several months prior, and sort of. I don't know. He said some fighting words about how there was no other way to grow other than organic soil, and that, you know, there was no other environmentally responsible way. And I thought that there, you know, at least was something to be discussed on that topic. So he suggested that, you know, we take time to sort of prepare ourselves to come back and have a debate on that topic. But I was reasonably well prepared, and I went in sort of representing the environmental interests of hydroponic growers, which I think, you know, there are real environmental benefits. We're growing indoors, meaning that our biggest environmental impact is the electricity that we're using for our grow setup, especially for our lights. And therefore, we want to grow quickly. And we want to grow successfully, because if we, you know, waste all this electricity and don't end up with a good harvest, then it's all well for naught, right? And for both of those reasons, I think that there's a compelling argument to be made, especially for new growers to go into cocoa, because I think that if they follow the guidelines that I have laid out at cocoaforcannabis.com, you know, our new growers have good success. And if you don't sort of believe my word on that, come to the chat room or come to the forum and read through the brand new growers grow journals. I mean, they're pulling really good harvests. And you know, you can go and try growing in soil, and maybe you're feeling like, well, my nutrients are more environmentally friendly, but you're having less success at actually growing cannabis, or you're growing less of it, or it's taking longer, or some new growers are just failing. All of that sort of offsets any of the environmental gains made from the other side. So you can see there's a whole argument that could be had there. But when I went in to sort of, you know, a number of Jeff's fans took exception to...
What, attacked you?
Not just my argument, but the fact that I was making an argument, or the fact that I would like dare to sort of even breach those ideas in public. So
that's why I love you, Dr. Coco, because I feel we're on that same page, which is what's wrong with having the discussion. I think it's great. I don't think you're doing your team a favor when you're attacking the figure that is the other side. I've always said that I support growers of all kinds on their journey. Of course, I would appreciate if they, you know, listened to my show and then slowly converted to all of my practices. But what kind of egotistical expectation is that to really happen? You know what I mean? Like, that's And I would also say, Dr. Coco, man, about the beginner thing, I don't know necessarily about the beginner part, but I would say if you don't have that pre-understanding of watering and soil and that green thumb, Dude, yeah. Huge advantage to growing coco. Let's be honest. I've never had that problem personally, but I see people who do. My wife is one.
That's the thing. I mean, growing in
grow, I would say go coco for the love of God.
Coco can be really formulaic. I can tell you when to water your plants based on what time of day it is. I don't need to look at the plants or feel the soil or pick up the pot or any of that crap. I'd be like, okay, it's been 8 hours. Go ahead and water again. It's just so much easier for brand new growers to know what to do and when to do it. And as long as you're paying attention, which is generally new growers pay a lot of attention to their plants, probably too much attention to their plants, right? They're helicopter gardeners. If you're willing to do that, you're going to have really excellent success with this. So, you know, Jeff and I got along great and we both enjoyed the episode. We had a good back and forth with it. We got off and, you know, after we ended the live stream, we chatted for a few minutes right there at sort of the end of the call before we got off the Zoom or Skype. I can't remember what it was.
I'd expect
it. Then I just started getting these comments back from outer space about how rude I was and how I was attacking him and things.
People are sensitive. And listen, this is coming from someone, man, especially, looking into coffee production practices, Dr. Coco, I am a fucking champion of natural agriculture, but I also understand that not everybody's going to think of, and not everyone's going to think like I do.
Well,
and
they
don't need to. You do what you can.
Yeah, I totally, in an outdoor setting, Jordan, I agree with you. I mean, outdoor, and I think that I disarmed Jeff to some extent because I started with that. Like, if you're growing outdoor, I'm not going to suggest that you fertigate your plants that are in the soil. I'm going to suggest that you cultivate a super soil and go with, you know, no-till methods.
That's really big coming from
work you. On biodynamic. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really important for field agriculture. I think that the reason that I grow in coco is because I'm not growing in a field. I'm growing in a grow tent in my office. And wow, man, it's cool. A totally different set of environmental practices to be concerned with there. When you're growing in the ground and you're adding nitrates and phosphates to the ground, some of that's going to end up in the water table. It's going to end up leaching out into other places. And that's an environmental contaminant. And we can largely prevent that, even if it's just by disposing of your runoff water in municipal wastewater. It's not getting into the environment that way. Like I was saying, in an indoor setting, we need to be much more concerned about sort of speed and doing this as efficiently as possible because
I had never thought of
the light.
Yeah.
And paying environmentally for the light. I mean, you're tricking yourself if you're, and this is why I brought up with Jeff was like, should we be growing indoors at all? I mean, if we're really driven by just the hard ecological argument on this, then we wouldn't be growing indoors at all.
Here's the thing.
Once we've made the decision, look, I'm going to grow indoors because it's worth it to me to grow indoors, then we have to consider the environmental impacts of growing indoors, which are different than the environmental impacts of growing in field agriculture. And I fully support organics. I fully support biodynamic agriculture for, you know, the agro-industrial complex. I think one of the biggest problems has been the proliferation of using fossil fuels and machinery instead of sort of those agroecology methods. But it takes a different form indoors. So 100%.
I'm so glad you said that though.
Yeah, I grow in coco indoors because I think it's more environmentally responsible than other ways of growing indoors, including organic soil, organic amendment, or organic fertigation.
And here's the thing. It's when you start externalizing it. You need to form your values internally and educate people by all means. But you're kidding yourself if you don't think that you are consuming and neglecting that on some level. Unless you live some crazy off the grid life and you're not listening to my podcast, then and somehow you're really not making an impact. Everybody consumes. It's just a fact. And when push comes to shove, like you said, Dr. Coco, how about you don't grow? How about you just don't smoke and use all of the cannabis for treatment of sick people? That would be the ethical thing to do.
Well,
no one lives a perfect life.
I mean, if the legal regime was different, right? If the legal regime didn't sort of regulate cannabis in a way that's different than regulating broccoli or corn, if cannabis was regulated the same way that corn was regulated, then I would advocate growing it as a field crop. You know, some people could get the sort of designer cuts in their gardens and things like that, but I wouldn't be advocating for growing under, you know, high intensity lights in a indoor space.
No, exactly. But what I'm saying is
the only reason for that is because of the legal regimes.
Right. My thing is it's the judgment that yes. that's the problem. You need right. to keep your values, live by those values and educate others. It's when you start judging other people, you're doing yourself a disservice and you don't want someone to start judging you back because we all have our own flaws. We are all consuming to some extent here. Again, unless you're some sort of crazy superhero Chris Trump, there's only a handful of those people.
Right.
You're good by lashing out.
And with the conventional fertilizers, everybody is so concerned about the conventional fertilizers themselves. You know, when I really think about the total environmental impact that I'm making, I think that, well, first of all, the manufacture of those fertilizers is more environmentally costly than the disposal. So everybody is concerned about the waste and the pouring the runoff or what do you do with the runoff. And yeah, that's a concern and you should be concerned about that. But you should also be aware that the biggest carbon impact of our fertilizers is in the manufacture of them, not in the disposal of them or sort of what happens to them on that side. So to be aware of that, but to be aware of that with your organic nutrients too and your organic inputs, where are they coming from? How are they sourced? How much fossil fuels were burned to get them to you? All of those things aren't something that sort of only applies. And, you know, to the extent that you're using, you know, bulky organic implements, the fossil fuel costs of delivering them to you may be more than the fossil fuel costs of conventional fertilizers.
Listen, there's smarter people who are going to have that conversation. My advice is just there's no reason for the hostility. You focus.
I totally agree.
You do what you can. I hope you do better than I do. You know, go as deep as you want to go into this stuff. It's when you start judging other people that you're not doing the community any service, I feel. But I love the exploration of the, again, I leave it to smarter individuals to figure it out and also the free market to an extent. But yeah, man, I feel like we could do this discussion all day. We should jump into plant training here, man.
Topic yet, Jordan? But oh no, God.
That was good. I like that, man.
And I think that's an important message that I like to keep getting out there: that you're not being environmentally irresponsible if you choose to grow hydroponically necessarily, or if you choose to grow in cocoa. We all are. Still responsible for making those environmentally conscious decisions, for responsibly sort of using our things, for not being wasteful, for disposing of things properly, all of that. But yes. It's not that you're being irresponsible just because of the way that you chose to grow in the first place. And right. Absolutely, I agree with your message of why can't we all sort of get along and be less.
It's different. A message of compassion, right? I mean, you can hold your values. Don't judge people's values for being different. And lash out at them, maybe try to educate them and guide them. It's a better road, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Before we return to the Doctor of Cocoa, let's shout out Trim Bag. Trim Bag, everyone, you can get your hands on a free Trim Bag. This episode is dropping late Wednesday night. You have a few hours, if you're listening to this after it drops, to go to growcastpodcast.com/giveaway and enter to win a Trim Bag. Now, if you're too late for that giveaway, there's a new one up, so go ahead and enter that one. But TrimBag has been so generous in giving away TrimBags to the GrowCast listeners. Have you not heard of TrimBag yet? Oh, you must go to TrimBag.com and make sure to use promo code GrowCast to get $30 off your TrimBag plus free shipping. TrimBag is exactly what it sounds like. It's a bladeless trimming bag that allows you to trim pounds in mere seconds, really. Just a few rotations can trim 2 pounds if you have the correct dryness. It's really a wonderful idea. If you have a lot of volume and you need it done quick and you still want good quality trimming results, Trim Bag is the answer. It has no blades that'll suck the buds in and mangle them. You can take it almost anywhere, and it's a fraction of the price of those big trimming machines, and you can still put in some serious volume. TrimBag.com, promo code GrowCast for $30 off plus free shipping. Make sure you're entering our giveaways. Someone's about to win a Trim Bag for free. All right, everyone, let's get back to Dr. Cocoa.
But I face that a lot. I face the sort of, you know, the feeling of that the organic growers sort of come at me like they're better than me or better than us.
All sides of every argument ever, man. There's something that humans do with teams. And maybe it segues nicely into the training question. Cause I mean, listen, I don't feel that strongly about this, but I stick to my plant training pretty religiously. And when Rob Smith tells me that he no longer recommends that people do topping and that low stress training is superior, I'm very, very skeptical.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I mean, that's what he said. And I'm sure if he was here, he would say, you got half the answer there, Jordan, and then elaborate. but yeah, I mean, everyone has their camps, right? And I've always been part of the topping camp. The question that I wanted to get to today with you is simply one that I get all the time, which is superior, topping, low stress training versus fimming? And what are we trying to do here? And what's the best course of action?
Yeah. So it's interesting. You kind of hit me with the Rob Smith likes low stress training thing here is a last minute wrinkle to my thoughts about this, but that I'm going to talk to you. I prefer topping. I top my plants several times, actually, including the autos that I'm growing right now.
Wow.
Yeah, I topped, I topped them on Monday. So today is, it's Thursday.
Talk about a big debate. Yeah, there's the debate over, I see people hating on autos and then people in the auto community saying, don't top only if it's a super auto. That's interesting.
You know, with autos, my rule is, well, you gotta do your topping before they hit the flowering period. You don't top a plant unless it's growing well, it's vigorous. And if you meet both of those requirements, go ahead and top. So I was on day 21 or something. And remember, I count days from when the seed gets wet. Not like a few days after the seed gets wet. So many people are counting their days from the day the seedling emerges or the cotyledons open or something. I'm like, why? It's just like count them from when you started, which was when you got the seed wet. So that's day one. I topped my the two autos that I'm growing in Tupper now. I think on day 21. I'm hedging on that a little bit because it might be day 22. And that was their first topping. It usually takes about 6 days, I find. I'm doing manifold training, which I grew them out to the sixth node.
No way.
I cut the plant in half, which means I topped it down to the third node. And now the two branches from the third node are growing out. When they get past their third node, I'll top them again. And that's probably going to be in a couple more days. Just like,
wait, isn't manifolding, don't you have to like tie down the branches from the very beginning and you get it to be where all the branches
are? Well, not from the very beginning. So, no, I top them. I did the initial topping and then clean off the growth tips from the first and second nodes, but I leave those leaves there. So after the first topping, there's only the two growth tips at the third node. Since they're the only two growth tips on the plant, and since the plant already has a fairly well-developed root structure and is able to sort of, you know, provide for itself at that point, those two tips become dominant and they start growing actually really fast. It's one of the cool things to watch is sort of those two growth tips explode with growth. So I've found it takes 6 days usually from the time I do the first topping to the time I do the second topping. So when I top them initially, those two little growth tips are just little growth tips. They often have their first node opened, and so they have like one set of leaves on them. And 6 days later, they're ready to, you know, they're pushing past the third node, and I can take the fourth off, the growth tip off then, and train them up into the manifold structure, which is leaving those tips on the third and those tips on the first, but cleaning off the second.
But you know, I was talking of, yeah, it does, but what is it like the main lining technique where they like tie down all of the,
Sorry, I didn't answer your question about tying down. I tie down the two main branches when I top them for the second topping. So I let them grow free for that 6 days after I do the first topping. And then I actually super crop them down. So I pinch the stem there.
Oh, wow. You do that high stress training. You bust it. Man, you're doing all the, that's crazy. You're doing all the stuff that I say is like, I just kind of, how many plants do you have, first of all?
I grow between 2 and 4.
Oh, well then that's the perfect time to do this type of stuff because you're not getting a whole big room.
Yeah. I grow big plants. Especially when I'm growing autos, because there's no way to sort of flip them earlier. They're just going to become giant plants. I really want to change the narrative about auto flowers being small plants. Auto flowers are only small plants if you have a difficult vegetation period. If the plant doesn't get growing, like the poor plants that I stunted by putting them into the poorly prepared cocoa, that they will be small plants. Because they didn't have the chance to sort of fully get their legs underneath them during veg. But if an auto flower grows well during the vegetation period, they grow into giant monsters of plants that I personally have a hard time controlling. So I'm not really worried. I train them out in the beginning to, have multiple growth to tops. So manifolding is two tops. So you top initially at the third node, you let each of the branches grow out so they have three nodes. You crop or LST those two branches down and you leave four growth tips on each branch. Two at the first node, two at the third node. That's a manifold. A mainline requires three toppings. So a mainline, you top at the third, the two branches grow out, you top them. You clean everything except for the ultimate tips. You grow those out and you top those four again to get eight that way.
Right. Okay. So that's okay. You have way more.
Yeah. I usually mainline photoperiod plants. But I often am kind of a little bit running out of time to do the third topping on autos.
Crazy.
So, you know, if you're growing like a 9 to 10 or longer week autoflowering strain, then you have about the first 30 days to mess around with stuff like this. But by day 30, I want to be done topping. So in like my current grow, I'm probably going to do the second topping on like day 27 or day 28. And that's just cutting it really close to be able to do the third topping by day 30. It's usually actually is only a couple of days between the second and third topping. But the cost benefit of sort of pushing it that much up against sort of their window, you want to be done with topping before the flowering period really starts, before the stretch starts. You want to be able to let them stretch into that new structure.
For sure. What do you think about fimming?
Not a fan. fimming.
Maybe let's define it. Instead of taking the top where you would normally take the top, like you're taking a cutting, what do you just slice right through the middle of the node?
Yeah. So a topping, you're actually going to cut through the stem, where you like cut the stem such that the plant above the point where you cut is removed. Topping. You actually sort of cut through you cut through the growth tip, the center apical growth cluster as the leaves are opening. And so you kind of cut halfway through it. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Mangles the leaves up. Sometimes it breaks apical dominance, sometimes it doesn't. If you do it perfectly, you can end up with four growth tips that are not exactly equal. And I think that that's an important point to raise. Fimming, once the plant recovers from fimming, if the fim was done properly, it will have four growth tips emerging there, but two of them will be dominant over the other two. And it's not going to lead to very symmetrical growth unless you do continued training at that point. So for that reason, I'm not a big fan. It takes longer for the plant to recover from a FIM than it does from a top. So I actually think it's faster to end up with four tops by topping twice than by
FIMing. Interesting. And you're also kind of echoing Rob Smith's sentiment, which is we all think about plant training to increase the tops, right? But he said what really you should be focusing on is making an even canopy. And that really changed my perspective. And that's what you were saying about the evenness as well, where it's like you need to be thinking of your leaves as little solar panels. You need to be arranging your canopy in a way that is even and symmetrical. Yeah. Has made where the surface area makes sense, because it's just a game of math and you're going to get
we're playing a little bit of semantics here too, because the top is a portion of the plant that's at the canopy. I don't think we should think about tops in that way as just being tops of a branch or of a cola, if that makes sense. It's like everything that's at the top, everything that's at the canopy. And we do want a lot of plant to be at that level, right? So I totally agree. We want a full, even canopy. That makes the positioning of the light easier. It makes the efficiency of the photosynthesis better. It really does wonders for your growth. Yeah. And so I agree with Rob that I think our entire sort of training practice is to promote an even canopy.
Now, I've never had experience with low stress training. Every time I've seen it, just didn't seem like nearly as quick and effective. I've only dealt with high numbers of plants, so now I'm more interested in something like a low stress training.
Right. So you just go through and top them, right?
Exactly, man.
Topping's easy. It doesn't require any kind of tying down or other things like that.
Oh my god! And then you got a handful of vigorous clones, so it's like, why wouldn't you? But now Rob is saying, you know, low stress is a great option for auto flowers because you're not really knocking back your plant's growth time severely.
I don't know. I think low stress training is. I don't want to call Rob out here too bad. I respect Rob a lot, but I think it's when you're scared to top. I think that, let's put it this way.
Rob's scared to top. Maybe the average grower will agree with you.
Right, but that's what I see a lot. I see a lot of growers like, it's my first grow. I think I'm going to top next grow. I'm just going to do LST in this grow. And for new growers, Rob, I'm sure, has the ability to get really equal results with his LST strategies.
I'll have him elaborate, but I'm going to tell him that you said he's scared to top.
No, don't tell him I said he's scared to talk. I'm sure he's able to get, I think it's easier for new growers to have success topping because I think it's just more straightforward what you have to do to get good results. And it requires, there's less art to
fair
it,
assessment.
Let's just say.
Yes.
The low stress training, you are sort of slowing down the plant and you're bending it over, right? So that you're going to try to get the apex of the plant lower than adjacent growth shoots. So auxins that are produced in the apical growth tip of the plant will flow downward. They won't flow upward. So if the apex of the plant, the final tip, is lower than other points along that branch, those other points along those branch will assume dominance, the higher points, the points that leave the branch at the highest point, if left like that, will become dominant. So that's a really important sort of knowledge to have, regardless of your overall training strategy, because we all use that to promote even canopy. When you have the one runaway cola, you can bend it down, get it lower. If you get the tip of it lower than one of its secondary branches, the secondary branch will take over a lot of the dominance, and it will sort of spread out that way better than having that one sort of runaway cola. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that it's a faster strategy necessarily. It strikes growers, especially when you see like the video of me cutting my plant in half, that I set my plant back, you'd think, by cutting it in half like that. But literally 6 days later, the plant is twice as big as it used to be, right? So in 6 days, I doubled the size of my plant, which is pretty good since it took, you know, a few weeks to get it to that size in the first place. So LST, I think, takes a little bit longer, really, in order to fill in. I think the bending of the plant down slows the growth of that apical or the terminal growth tip. It does promote the other ones, the secondary branches, but not really as effectively as topping, which just totally removes the source of the auxins.
And I think that the shock from topping, if you have your grow dialed in, isn't so bad. There definitely is a shock, like a stopping of growth briefly. But if you have everything dialed in, it's not so bad. And then maybe
I haven't noticed that. And I just did a time lapse of my plants in their second containers. It looks like the branches that I topped to got a jolt of adrenaline from the topping. It does not look like they were slowed down at all. And that's the experience that I have in general, is that it actually really promotes the growth of those lower branches.
I wonder how that ties in with the medium though. And like, for instance, what I was just going to say is if you time it around certain things, like you don't want to stress it certainly with an overwatering before a topping, or even I would say like a transplant before a topping, because that's going to compound the stress. Maybe that's just my, you know, kind of grow bro science, but I don't like to compound those stressors.
I agree with that. I try to separate at least onto different days topping and transplanting, which is tough because often plants are ready to be topped at about the same time.
About the same time, exactly.
Transplanted. And I've been thinking about that ever since I wrote the transplanting article last year, and I kind of hedged. I was like, you can do it in either order, either top first and then transplant, or transplant first and then top. But I actually now think that it's better to top in the second containers and then transplant into the final containers. That's assuming you're doing a three-step strategy, though.
Interesting. Yeah, because that's going to be my kind of first experience. Like, traditionally, it was, you know, cuttings go into a cocoa mat. I was a big fan of those cocoa mats. Those go into like a small little square container, maybe a 1 gallon, and then straight into my 3 gallons, which I would then fertigate with my synthetic nutrients. Now that I'm going to have to work up to a 7 gallon with my super soil, and I'm trying to figure out how that's going to work.
Well, I would just do the second step. So you go straight into a 1 gallon. Is that your seedling container?
So for this run, I'm doing seedlings for the first time, and they're in a party cup right now.
Okay.
So like I want to go. So I was thinking party cup 1 gallon.
I'd go bigger on that second step, and I would only.
No. I'm sorry, I misspoke. I just spoke with Rizzo Rich. He recommended I go party cup 3 gallon, which I thought was too big of a jump, but he said it was a good idea.
Yep.
There you go, and then just straight from the 3 gallon into the 7, obviously.
Yeah, you could do two or three is what I was gonna say. For that second step in soil, it's especially if you're fertilizing them that way, that it gives them more media to work with.
So that's the same amount of jumps then. It's just that back in the day, it would start in a cube.
In that 3 gallon container, I definitely think I would do at least my initial topping, if you're going to top them while they're still in that 3 gallon container, and then let them fully recover from the topping, if they have to recover from the topping, in that 3 gallon container before transplanting.
Love it. Yeah, that's really exciting. Now, did you want to finish up topping? I have a couple questions about bottoming.
You know, topping is easier. I think all you're doing is cutting off the top of the plant. You can cut the plant like in half, like I'm doing. It doesn't set you back as long as you think it's going to. And I guess my sort of pushback to Rob would be that I think tying the plant down, like you really need to do in low stress training, is a different kind of stress to the plant, and that certainly slows down the tip of the growth tip off the top, or what used to be.
Maybe it's not as low stress as we give it its
title for.
The other
thing about low stress training is it's high risk. Topping is not high risk. So stress refers to the plant, not you, the gardener. So when we say low stress, you know, it's low stress to the plant because it's not losing anything. It's just getting bent over. But it can be pretty high stress if you snap the stem while you're doing it. I mean, high stress to you, the gardener.
Good point.
And it's high risk to do that because you're always sort of pushing the tensile strength of the branches, right? The tensile strength of the stem. And if you push it a little too far, it snaps and you have a major plant injury to contend with. That never happens with topping. I mean, topping, you're injuring the plant on purpose, but strategically. And there's no sort of risk with topping. There's a huge risk with LSTing your plant 90 degrees like that. So to be aware of that, I think that as a new grower, it's attractive. The low stress sounds like, oh, this is something I can handle. But it's actually a more advanced technique than topping, and it requires sort of more expertise to master.
Right on. We should have a follow-up discussion, which I look forward to. But you're often teaching growers, and if you're recommending someone who's training their plants, I mean, it's just so much easier for just a quick and easy top. And that's what I'm doing this run. I'm going to play around with some low-stress training, but not this run. I'm not doing a first time.
Well, I mean, I always do some low-stress stuff. I'm moving colas around and bending different branches down and stuff like that.
Right, when you get down to it, yeah.
Primary training technique, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have some growers that do low-stress training all of the time as their primary technique and have really good results with it. But, again, I think that it's one of these things that once you learn how to do it, it's an art a little bit more. Topping is
for sure
really formulaic. It's like wait until the plant has 6 nodes and then cut it in half and then wait until those next things. You know what I mean? It's like,
I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah, there's less sort of skills to master when it comes to that kind of training.
So cool. Bottoming, shaving the legs, as the great Wolfman says. Anyone who adopts that term must credit the great Wolfman.
Shaving the legs.
Shaving the legs.
Okay. Yeah.
No, not bottoming. but I.
We usually call it lollipopping, but I think we're talking all about the same thing.
100% lollipopping, same idea. It's removing that lower growth.
Yeah.
I've found that growers are often not aggressive enough with their.
There's bottom. Two things. So there's bottom branches and growth tips, and then there's also leaves. And I really think when you're pruning your plants, you should think about these things differently. It's very rare that I go around and cut off fan leaves and growth tips together. Sometimes there's a reason to cut off the growth tip. Sometimes there's a reason to cut off the fan leaf. Those reasons usually don't coincide.
Wow, that's news to me, man. I go through when it's time to bottom and I clean it up. Is that not a best strategy?
It depends on how you want to manage your climate. You remove fan leaves only really to manage climate within the tent.
Right.
If you don't need to remove them, if your humidity is not too high, you should leave them.
So even when you're cutting it, you're saying, "Hey, I'm getting rid of this. I know this is going to be larf in the future down here on the lower branch."
Larf is on growth tips.
That's what I'm saying. So when you're doing that, you're cutting around, you're missing the leaf. You're purposefully missing the leaf.
Well, I'm cutting the branches off with the base, but there's a fan leaf there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And you're leaving it.
I leave it. That's really what I mean by hashtag leave the leaves.
No cut shit.
The tips, leave the leaves. Yeah, now you cut those leaves off if you need to for climate reasons. And oftentimes there's a reason to. Let me explain why you leave those leaves. They're a bank for the plant to draw nutrients from later on. There's mobile nutrients that plants have in their leaves that they can suck out of those leaves if they need to redistribute them to other parts of the plant. And if you've ever left any of those bottom leaves, you'll notice that the plant does that because those leaves turn yellow. That's the plant pulling nutrients out, and they wither and they turn brown and they die. They'll fall off the plant. That's the plant taking advantage of that leaf as a resource.
Right.
If you've cut that leaf off, the plant doesn't have that as a resource.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
So you cut it off because the leaf that's not getting any light is not doing any photosynthesizing, right? So if it's really buried down there, it's not doing any photosynthesizing, and it still is transpiring. So that transpiration is not getting you sort of any
action
production, right? Yeah. So if the transpiration is becoming a problem, then you should get rid of those leaves, because the sort of stored nutrients that they hold isn't sort of worth the climate problems that they're causing. But no, especially early on in training, and this is a problem I see almost everybody make when they're doing manifolds, is that they cut off the leaves when they're cutting off the tips. And they end up with like a naked little plant that only has leaves at the growth tips that are still growing.
That's what I do. It's clean. It's bare down there.
No, don't leave the leaves. So on the main stalk, you should still have the single fan leaf from the first node. You should still have the triple fan leaf from the second node. But you shouldn't have either of the growth tips. So you go in there with your pruning scissors and you cut off the growth tips, which is above the leaf. You know, you can go down sort of above the leaf. I do it pretty early while the growth tips are still pretty small, because there's no use in letting the plant invest its resources in a growth tip that I'm going to eventually cut off.
Damn, dude, this is fascinating, because I do it more like just kind of timing. Like I do let them get further along. It doesn't make sense to let them get further along. I just wait for when it's time to do that, you know, like a week before flip.
But leave the leaves, right? But
leave the leaves. Interesting.
Powering photosynthesis that helps the whole plant grow.
Now, like you said, my experience is that everyone's experience is that those lower leaves eventually begin to fade, wither, die, and eventually fall off. When do you pluck those? Wolfman always told me if it comes off easy, then that's the time with a gentle tug. Is that what you recommend?
I agree. If they're coming off, if they're falling off, you can pull them off. If it looks like the plant's already sort of sucked all the life out of the leaf, then you can go ahead and cut it off. Just to be aware that's what's going on, right? The plant is... the reason those leaves wither and die, it's not really a nutrient deficiency issue as much as it's just the plant repurposing what it has available. It recognizes that leaf isn't doing photosynthesis anymore, and it starts pulling those nutrients to a part of the plant that is. Once it's stripped the nutrients out of there, the leaf's not doing anything for you anymore, so you can go ahead and get rid of it. But again, there's not a prescriptive reason to get rid of it other than the climate reason.
Well, that's what I love too, is that airflow under there. You know,
right.
Never had a mold.
And that's why you do it. If you need the airflow, if you're running, but you know, a lot of growers have the opposite problems. If you're growing, especially as we enter into the summer, growers that are trying to do ventilated grows that live in really dry climates, you know, if I set my tent on full vent now to control the heat, I can drop the humidity in my tent down to the 30s.
Oh, shit. In which case you want more leaves is what you're saying?
In which case I'd want more leaves on my plants if I wanted to run like that. Now I can control the fans and everything else. I don't have to run that hot. But you can see that we're used to thinking about too much humidity being the problem. But it's not always the problem. So I think that's a good sort of review about the leaves in that and throughout the rest of the growth. So it's not a problem to have a plant with a bunch of leaves in the under canopy, but you don't want a plant that has a bunch of like proto flowers and growth tips, little branches that just got buried under the canopy. If you achieve what Rob Smith and I are going for with this nice even canopy, you really want most of the flower production focused there. And if you have too many lower growth tips, too many budding sites, they won't get the attention of the plant. And that's what becomes larf. Larf won't develop. Well, let's put it this way. If there's not too many of them, the buds that are shaded out will grow to be wonderful, fully mature buds, just like the buds that aren't shaded out. The buds don't need light to mature. What the plant will prioritize different parts of the plant differently if it can't meet all of its needs. And in that case, the plant will prioritize the parts of the plant that are getting the light. But as long as the plant isn't sort of too big for its britches, all of the growth underneath will mature as well, because the plant will be able to develop it and sort of support that. So there's a lot of growers that try that cut fan leaves off to like expose buds to the light. Oh my God, that's one of the things that just sends chills up my spine, because the plant does not The bud does not need to be exposed to the light in order to mature. The plant does need leaves that are exposed to the light, though, in order for those buds to mature. So you're really shooting yourself in the foot if you cut off a leaf that's getting light because you're trying to expose a flower to that same
kind of light. Kind of sound like you said shitting yourself in the foot. Why do those high defoliation, high fertigation techniques work?
I really am not convinced that they do work.
I've seen people have success with them and stuff, you know, online. I mean, maybe it's not the best way to do it, but I'd imagine that would be very, very damaging, I guess is what I'm saying. But
when you look at how much light those growers are using, though, their yields would be higher if they grew in a more traditional way.
All right, interesting.
So if you overlight your plant, if you defoliate it, but you're making sure that the plant still has, you know, 700 to 1,000 micromoles of PPFD hitting every single inch of that plant, which means you're wasting a lot of light, basically, in order to achieve that. You can still grow really good plants. But if you had that much light over a nice, even canopy of non-defoliated plants, you'd have a much larger harvest.
Right. That makes sense.
And so to that extent, that's what I mean, like, it doesn't work. And we've talked about this before. I remember talking about, like, you know, the sexy Instagram pictures of these giant colas. They look good in that regard. I personally am not interested in growing those giant colas because I have enough experience curing bud to know that that's just a huge pain in my butt, to know that that's where mold develops even when you have your environment really well dialed in. So, and it's not the way to develop the best quality cannabis. I personally believe that the best quality cannabis is, like, not the middle of a giant cola, if that makes sense. It would be like the edges of a smaller cola, maybe.
Right, sure.
That gets back to our topping thing. That's one of the reasons that we break apical dominance and train plants with multiple branches, multiple tops like that, so that none of them actually do grow to be that big, because those big colas like that create mold and curing problems.
Makes sense. Yeah, I think we've all run into that issue.
But yeah, you can still, you're not going to kill the plant. If you leave, you know, the sugar leaves and some of the leaves, there will be enough photosynthesis. If you cut off all the sugar leaves, the plant's going to die. So if you keep going with that strategy that some of those Instagram growers are on, you can certainly get to the point where the obvious problems of this technique will make themselves readily apparent.
Interesting. Love it. Listen, we're coming up here already. We're going pretty long. Can't start another question. We'll wrap it here. What's going on? CocoaForCannabis.com. Auto Flower Challenge is going on right now. I'm in it. Come join CocoaForCannabis.com. Check out the Grow Light Calculator, the collab with Shane, of course. If you haven't heard that episode, go back and listen.
Yeah,
anything else? Anything else to update? That about covers it, right? Dr. MJ Coco on Instagram.
I added a few more fixtures to the calculator just in the last few days.
Nice.
I'm going through and trying to do that. I'm reaching out to some companies to set up some new tests for grow lights going forward. This is our finals week, so I'm pretty much done with the semester. I just have to enter my grades, finish grading stuff, enter my grades. And then I'm on summer break, which means that I get to spend, you know, all of my working hours on Coco for Cannabis stuff. So I got a bunch of fun plans that will be putting out new content and new stuff, here in May and into June and July. I just got a bunch of stuff lined up. So yeah, head on over to Coco for Cannabis. Check out our Grow Challenge. Check out our cannabis chat room, where there's always people hanging out, ready and willing to chat about cannabis stuff. And all of the articles there's an article on training, on topping, on manifold training, on a number of the topics that we've covered in today's show that you may be interested in. So head over to our table of contents and check all of that out.
Love it. You know what to do, at Growcast on Instagram, at Jordan River IG to get at me personally.
That'll Dr. Happen. MJ Coco on Instagram too.
Dr. MJ Coco on Instagram. Let's do a live. I'm doing IG lives. Maybe we'll do something. So we're going to do more collaborations. Stay tuned, listeners. But that's all for today. Dr. Coco and Jordan River, we're signing off. We're saying be safe and grow smarter.
And grow our love.
That concludes today's program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I do appreciate you. Real quick, we've been getting asked a lot for the AC Infinity promo code. AC Infinity makes the best inline front fans in the grow industry. The promo code for acinfinity.com is GrowCast15. GrowCast15 gets you 15% off your AC Infinity fans. Their Cloudline series is the best. If you need a new fan, grab an AC Infinity fan. acinfinity.com. Again, the promo code is GrowCast15 for 15% off. Lots of people have been asking for that. Love acinfinity.com. Shout out to Start to Finish for all your consulting needs. Every situation, every setup, we've got you covered. Start to Finish. Start to Finish 710 on Instagram. Shout out to Jay Blanked for doing the beat. SoundCloud.com/JayBlanked. Thank you all so much for staying subscribed, for downloading loyally. I hope you're doing great things in your garden. Take care of yourself out there. Make sure to stay safe, stay healthy. This is Jordan River wishing you an extraordinary day. We'll see you next time on GrowCast, everyone. Bye-bye.